recording now? Little wavy things going across. Okay, now on the bottom you'll see the EW for Easy Worship. Go ahead and click on that. Bottom of the screen, there we go. Okay, turn your Bibles to Romans chapter 14, verse 5. Romans 14, verse 5. This is, actually it's a passage that John Wesley cited quite a bit. Now, the book of Romans deals with an enormous amount of church structure and church activities, and Paul spent a fair amount of time talking about what you should eat and how you should eat it and how you should worship. And so I'll wait till you finish tapping on your app or looking in your book. Pastor Packer, that's free for you. So Romans chapter 14, verse 5. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. And Wesley talked a lot about that, and we'll talk about Methodism. As a matter of fact, today we're going to spend most of our time talking about the Methodist Church, because much of Methodism finds its origins in the experiences John and Charles Wesley have in the New World in Georgia, which, by the way, was not a happy time. But when they talked about church structure and church order, this was what their focus was. Be persuaded that what you're doing is the way God intends it to be done. Charles and John Wesley developed a method for proper church worship. Technically, they never intended to start a denomination. Much like Martin Luther, their objective was to take the existing churches, provide a proper formal structure, so that church could worship as they believed the Bible dictated. And as a result of this structure and their book of prayer and their book of church order, the Methodist denomination grew out of that. But it's important to remember, Charles in particular never really intended that. Charles always considered himself affiliated with the Anglican Church. Now, before we jump into early churches, we need to talk about the things that distinguish the various denominations. And we're going to look at four things: baptism, eschatology, sacraments, and the question of free will. We'll start with baptism. The primary division over the churches was whether it was appropriate to sprinkle with baptism or whether baptism required immersion. The Anabaptists required immersion. The Presbyterians kind of went back and forth on it. Obviously, the Anglicans and the Catholics were more sprinkling-oriented. But the question then was, what is the proper mode of baptism? That doesn't become a significant church question until you get to the end of the 1600s and early 1700s, which will give rise to what we now know as the modern Baptist movement. It's interesting, when I was in Bible college, Dean Ryder used to say, you can't call him John the Baptist because he wasn't a Baptist. We call him John the Baptizer. I don't know if Pastor Packard had that. Where did you go to Bible college? Baptist Bible. I think they have the same position there. Now, the other question, of course, was infant baptism. The more charismatic of the denominations, the Congregationalists, the Free Will, the Moravians, stayed away from infant baptism. They said that baptism follows a true confession of faith, and obviously infants can't do that. And then, of course, the whole debate over the necessity of baptism. Now, interesting, and I'm not sure if pastors were aware of this or not, I did not realize how old a debate over the necessity of baptism is. In 176 A.D., one of the earliest church councils, this whole question of whether baptism is an essential component of salvation or not was discussed. I didn't realize it was that old a debate. And the Catholic Church at that point decided that it was a sacrament, in other words, an essential element of exercising your faith, but baptism was not necessary as a component of salvation. But I did not realize that the debate had been going on that long. So, mode of baptism, infant baptism, whether it's essential to salvation, eschatology or a theory of the future. The oldest and longest-running theory of eschatology is amillennialism. It's the idea that the book of the Revelation is allegorical, the discussion of the tribulation, all that is allegorical. Amillennialism basically posits that the seven-year tribulation is occurring here on earth now. Okay? So an amillennialist says that seven-year tribulation is a picture of the horrible things that are going on earth now, and the thousand-year millennial reign of Christ is also happening now, but it's happening in heaven. In other words, it's an allegory for life on earth, life in heaven. Now, if you're an amillennialist, the question of the rapture gets a little complicated. Modern amillennialists believe that at the end of the age there will be a rapture as Christ comes back, but that the marriage supper of the Lamb is not a real thing. It's just a representation of the joys that we'll have in heaven. This was the dominant worldview. Catholics developed this view. The earliest writing from an amillennial perspective is 350 A.D. Augustine was an amillennialist, Thomas Aquinas. The alternative, you'd think, would be premillennialism, which treats the ages outlined in the Bible as literal. But premillennialism is kind of the newcomer. The second was postmillennialism, which arose in the mid-1300s. That's the idea that all of scriptural prophecy has been fulfilled except for the return of Christ. We've already had the seven-year tribulation. The Antichrist has already come. And postmillennialism says that the church is triumphant and that what is happening now is that the church will evangelize the entire world, the entire world will become Christians, and then Christ will return. Now, postmillennialism had its greatest run from 1817 until 1914. In fact, that great period of the 1860s forward was considered the height of postmillennialism. The world is getting better. We're developing vaccines. We've developed aspirin, and you'd be amazed how much aspirin had impact on the human condition, because previous to that, there were no general painkillers other than things like morphine and laudanum and opiate derivatives. And so technology is growing. We're learning about viruses. Science is going crazy. We've got steam power. And everybody says, see, the world's getting better and better and better, and then 1914 comes and World War I. And the old saying is World War I killed postmillennialism and World War II gave it a proper Christian funeral. Postmillennialism was dead for a very long time. And then in 1998, the PCA, Presbyterian Churches of America, revived it, and now PCA churches are postmillennial by doctrine, which to me is kind of fascinating. You know, the postmillennialists believe that Christ, the churches are making the world a better place, things are improving, and that takes a leap of faith, at least in my book. Premillennialism, late 1600s, is when the idea is developed. That's the idea that you have the death, burial, and resurrection, the church age. At the end of the church age, you will have the rapture of the church, a literal seven-year tribulation, Christ's return, a literal thousand-year reign of Christ, and then the judgment seat in eternity future. And we Baptists are premillennial, and by and large, Baptists have always been premillennial. There are certain divisions of the denomination that follow a amillennialism. The American Baptist movement played around with postmillennialism, and then they played around with amillennialism, and I noticed recently the American Baptists have kind of come back to a premillennial position. Yeah. Yes, yeah, you're right, the Reformed. Most Reformed movements are, you know, because the PCA is a Reformed movement, the Reformed Baptists are postmillennial, the Reformed Episcopals are postmillennial. Interestingly enough, the American Methodist Episcopal Church are largely postmillennial, which is surprising because most African American churches are amillennial in their eschatology. The sacraments. The first question is, how many sacraments are there? Catholic Church says there are 10. The Episcopal say there are 7. You're thinking 7, Ray. I'm saying that I learned 7. Well, there are 3 that are relate to the priesthood. But there are 7 sacraments for the general the laity, and then there are 3 added on for the priests. I was going to bring my Catholic missal, but I thought that would give Ray too many flashbacks. I was going to say, I thought that would give you too many flashbacks to nuns with rulers. And Now, the Baptists have two sacraments. And what are they? What are the two sacraments of the Baptist Church? Communion and baptism. Now, the question of communion has been one of the great challenges. Catholics, Episcopals, Anglicans, some elements of Presbyterianism are what we call transubstantiationists. I'm not going to make you say that. The idea of transubstantiationism is that when you take the bread and the wine, it literally becomes the body and blood of Christ. So in other words, as you take the bread and the wine, it transforms its substance, transubstantiationism, to become body and blood. Some elements of Presbyterians, some versions of Methodists and the Lutherans are consubstantiationists. It's the idea that as you take the elements, the bread and body, or the body and the blood become commingled within the bread and the wine. And then Baptists, Charismatics, Congregationalists are what we call asubstantiationists. The bread and the wine are bread and the wine. They are symbolic rather than literal. And it comes down to Jesus instituting the Last Supper, says, "Take, eat, this is my body." Did he mean that literally, or was he being symbolic? It's interesting that the Catholic Church's mode of interpretation is generally allegorical, except when they get to that passage. And all of a sudden they abandon their allegoricalism and say, well, he meant that literally. And I haven't put up their mode of interpreting the text, but we'll talk about that as we get going. The last question is the question of free will. Do we have complete free will? In other words, has God predetermined who will be saved and who will not be saved, or is it a matter of elective free will? And the basic division there is between John Calvin, whose primary works are in the 1530s to the 1550s, who says we are predestined from the beginning, before the foundation of the world, God knew who'd be saved and who'd be lost. God's grace is just for those who are saved. The modern Calvinist says that Jesus' death is sufficient for the whole world, but it is efficient only for the elect. In other words, Christ died for the whole world, but he only meant it for just those of us who are going to be saved. Calvin would have thought that was a weakening. His doctrine was that Jesus died only for those who are going to be saved. He did not die for those who were not going to be called by the irresistible call. Luther substantially departed from him on this doctrine. Luther wasn't completely in the idea. Now, free will is the doctrine that each one of us has complete free will to choose Christ or not. It is not predetermined. It's all about our elective will based on the call of God. It is a doctrine, Grotius, Hugo Grotius in the 1520s articulates this doctrine kind of as a challenge to the Catholic doctrine of predestination and election. Luther is challenging Grotius. This is what we call Arminianism. John Wesley was Arminian in that free will trumped predestination. John Wesley, there's some disagreement between the brothers on this issue, and part of it has to do with their experiences in Georgia. Yes. Yeah, Arminianism says salvation is completely up to us. The Spirit will draw and put it out there, but we make that elective choice. Predestination says, Calvin said, the irresistible call. That once God calls you to salvation, it is an irresistible call, and you will submit to it because that's predestined. Yeah. And whereas the Arminians say, no, it's all about your free will. God calls, but you have that complete free will to choose. By and large, Baptists believe in predestination, but this is a complicated issue for us. I'm sure Pastor Packard has wrestled with this as a pastor in counseling. I mean, for Baptists, it's a complex issue because we believe in free will, but we also believe in predestination. How many of you remember about 3 years ago, Pastor Stitzel did a three-sermon arc on this and concluded that he was very confused. Which I think is the traditional Baptist position on that question. We believe in predestination, but we believe in free will, so it's sort of like how my grandfather used to resolve the eschatology question. Are you an amillennialist, a premillennialist, or a postmillennialist? My grandfather used to say he was a panmillennialist. It would all pan out in the end. And that was his position on predestination. In terms of the practical impact of predestination, as long as you have made that profession in Christ, the question is largely irrelevant at that point. No. All right, so these are the elements that the early church in America is wrestling with, because the church as a whole is wrestling with this. I'll go ahead and give me my first slide, so down arrow. Click on it and then down arrow. Yeah, click on the slide there. Click on it over there. Over there. Click. There we go. All right. Okay, the colonial experience influences religion as much as it does politics and philosophy. The difference between the English colonies and the Spanish, French, and Russian colonies was the doctrine of what we call benign neglect. Spain tried to govern the colonies from Madrid and Segovia. In other words, they tried to govern the colonies directly and didn't give the colonial governors much private authority. The French, much the same way. The Russians, because they were closer and were more in the west, had a little more direct control. But the English colonists, the English government recognized that trying to govern a colony and making decisions with a 4 to 6 month sea voyage was a bad idea. And so the colonies had what was called benign neglect. They could establish themselves. A private charter was given to somebody, and then that person's job was to run the colony. If it made money, great, they got taxed. If it didn't make money, the king wasn't out anything. And if the colony collapsed and faded and died, well, that was a private person's investment problem, not the crown. But what that means is we think of the colonies as sort of like states today with a state structure and all that. But most of the colonies were actually a collection of cities. And in the New England colonies, these cities were autonomous and self-governed. They established a city charter, they elected their city council, they made their laws, they did their taxes on their own, then they took the revenue and sent it back to the crown. But they really pretty much did their own decisions. And as a consequence, this idea of the autonomy of the local body permeates into the local church as well. And keep in mind, the primary churches at the time are the Anglican Church. We've got a bunch of Lutherans running around, Presbyterians, and that's kind of it. Now you got the Puritans, but the Puritans technically are Anglicans. It's the Pilgrims who are separating out, and they're in there and they're building their body, and they've got a bishop or an overseer who's trying to administer these churches. But very quickly, particularly in New England, the idea becomes: now wait a minute, why should I have this guy who's beholden to some foreign national telling us what our doctrine is, our church structure, and our church order, and appointing ministers to us? And so very quickly, at least in New England, the idea of the local autonomy of the local church develops. And out of that grows what we call the Congregationalist movement. The Congregationalist denomination is established in the New World fairly quickly. By 1723, in the North, you've got a division between the Puritans, the inheritors of the Pilgrim tradition, and the Congregationalists, which will cause all sorts of wonderful political stuff, which we'll talk about later. But the Congregationalists said it's up to the local church to decide their church structure, to elect their pastor, to appoint their leadership, and to choose doctrine. So if you're a member of the Congregationalist denomination, if your church is affiliated with the Congregationalists, you don't necessarily have even a common doctrinal statement. We are members of the General Association of Regular Baptists. It's a little complicated. We don't consider ourselves a denomination. We consider ourselves an association, a free association of fellow members. But we do have a doctrinal statement that says, if you want to associate with us, these are the things that we as General Association of Regular Baptists believe. We call ourselves an association rather than a denomination or assembly. Because the idea is that we are in free association and we can quit the association at any time. And this is a derivative of the Congregationalist idea. What we consider modern regular Baptists have their roots in the Congregationalist tradition, but we'll talk about them in a bit because a lot of other churches grow out of that as well. But imagine having an association of churches where there's no common doctrinal statement. So I could be associated as a Congregationalist church, I could sprinkle. As a Congregationalist church, I could baptize. We could be all millennial, you could be post-millennial. We could believe that the Bible is largely allegorical, we could believe in the literal, and we could all be in the Congregationalist tradition, which caused enormous conflict as the denomination grew. Okay, next. Now, not all American churches, not all American churches submitted to the idea of the local church autonomy. Particularly in the South, the churches were Anglican, Lutheran, Presbyterian movement took root in the South. And that's because the difference was the Southern colonies, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee eventually, Virginia, were all proprietary colonies, which means that they were established by a charter from the crown, and those who were coming over here were in good standing with the crown, and many of them were members of parliament, and to be in that position you had to be in good standing in the Anglican Church. When you talk about the northern colonies, New England colony, Pennsylvania, parts of New York, the Delaware colony, Maryland, all of those were established kind of to get away from the dominant power of the Anglican Church to establish religious liberty. And so you see this independent tradition much more in the northern colonies than you did in the southern colonies. Georgia, for example, the state's church was the Anglican Church. James Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia, was a member of good standing in Parliament. He was a high church official. He had no problem with the Anglican structure, and so he brought that over. Now, what makes Oglethorpe different from South Carolina was that he, when confronted with the problem of religious expatriates, the Salzburgers fleeing persecution in Switzerland, the Moravians coming over, rather than force them to pay a tax to the state church, he simply wrote in the Georgia Charter independence, and they would establish their little towns, and they would run, the Salzburgs established a town south of Savannah in which Lutheranism was the dominant religion. But all of them worked under the umbrella, even though the official colonial church was still the Anglican Church. So when we think of church autonomy, we're talking more about the northern colonies than we are the southern colonies. Georgia was Anglican. North Carolina, South Carolina were Episcopal. Episcopal is the American version of Anglicanism. The difference was whether or not the Episcopal see the Archbishop as the head of the church, the Anglican see the king, actually, I guess today the queen, as the leader of the church and the defender of the faith. The Presbyterian Church makes big inroads. Once you get up and embedded in the Appalachian Mountains, you start to see the Presbyterian Church really take off as opposed to the Anglican Church. Georgia, we don't see that because Georgia doesn't have much of a mountain tradition, but South Carolina, North Carolina, eventually Tennessee, the upstate of Virginia, you start to see Presbyterians really have influence. And part of that's different. The Anglican Church is the upper crust church. It's the church for the wealthy and the well-to-do. Presbyterians are more for the middle class. Next slide. Okay, back a slide. There we go. We're going to look at five key denominations. As I said, we'll spend most of our time on the Methodists, largely because the Methodists, in the American context, they're just really interesting. Charles and John Wesley are the founders of the Methodist. Initially, it's a movement, and then it becomes a denomination. They get many of their ideas for church structure by their time in Georgia. They come in Georgia in 1736. John Wesley is the military secretary for James Oglethorpe. Charles Wesley is coming over as part of a missionary society and Bible translators. Charles Wesley is coming to work with the Indians. John Wesley is coming to work with the colonial government. Bad times. John Wesley hated everything about the colonies. He hated the trip over. He got seasick. He hated Savannah. It was not a cultured town that he was used to. His biggest complaint was he could not find a harpsichord in 500 miles. Just despised it. He hated North Carolina. He hated South Carolina. He thought the South Carolinians were all drunkards. And he was probably right. He made one trip to Boston, and he thought they were all posers. So as soon as his two-year tenure was up, he was on the ship and he was back home. There's a great story that most of John Wesley's hymns, when he's writing about hell and death and all of that, the story is that he wrote most of them while he was in Georgia. Charles Wesley was a little different. Charles Wesley, not that he liked the colonial experience, but he really found it interesting, and he found the natives in Georgia just endlessly fascinating. Charles is a little more intellectual than John, and Charles traded stories with the Indians, had a fairly successful missionary work. His problem was he fell in love with a girl. The girl fell in love with somebody else. Charles got mad and excommunicated the both of them from the church. Now, you got to keep in mind, he's in his late 20s, early 30s when all this is happening. Wrote a number of beautiful hymns about the travel. He's got a wonderful hymn it's hard to find anymore, about going through the time in the desert before the Promised Land, and he's talking about Georgia. And he considered Savannah the time in the desert, but then he did a travel upstream to what now is called modern-day Dahlonega, where gold is found, and he found this little Indian tribe that was kind of separated from all of the others, and he spent 3 weeks there. They were open to evangelism. A number of conversions happened. Wonderful stuff. It was a land that was largely untouched. Just fruit was hanging off the trees, and he thought this was as close to paradise on earth as you could get. Then he got dysentery and decided it was time to come home. So poor old John and Charles. Much of their thinking about the church and what the church needed to do was established by their time in the colonies. Because what had happened was the Anglican Church is very structured. The Anglican Church is just a British version of the Catholic Church. You've got the Archbishop and bishops on down, and it's very structured. And then you've got the Lutherans, who had practically no structure at all. Martin Luther believed that salvation was by grace alone, and you didn't need much else. And so his church was kind of a Wild West. Calvin was much more organized and much more structured. And then you've got the Moravians, and then you've got Zwingli. And there was no consistency in church structure. And as that was planted into the colonies, very often your church leadership were uneducated. And so there was no real church structure. And Charles and John Wesley said, you know, what we need is a common church order, an order of service, an order of worship, a set of general doctrines that can be used across denominations. And so that became their goal, was to develop a method for church worship, which is why they chose the term Methodist. Go ahead, next slide. Okay, time did convince them that the church does need structure and reform, so they developed what is known for the Methodists. Now, the Methodists actually began at Oxford University, and Charles and John and George Whitefield were all part of this movement, a group of students known as the Bible Bigots. Now, you have to understand, college education at this time was a classical education. You learned Latin, you learned Greek, you learned Hebrew, you read the classical writings, and you focused a lot on religion. But religion at this point, 17-teens through 1730s, in England was staid, it was formalist. There was no life in it. And John and Charles had fun with it. I mean, it was okay. Their father was a member of the clergy. But when they got to college, they ran into the precursors to the Pentecostal movement. These were people who read the Bible, took it seriously, believed in the Holy Spirit, and believed that God wanted to do real works. And this group became known as the Bible Bigots. They devoted their time to prayer, they devoted their time to Bible study, and they devoted their time to witnessing. In other words, trying to evangelize their fellow students. And so they became the Bible Bigots, they became the Bible Thumpers. You know, anything that Baptists had been called, these guys were called first. And Charles and John Wesley said, now, if our faith is real, and if it matters, and if it's different from what else we've seen, we've got to do something to carry it out. And they became very evangelical, and some parts of Methodism played around. Well, the charismatic movement, the modern charismatic movement, grows out of the Methodist revival movement in the United States. All right, next slide. Okay, these groups believed that the church should devote time to specific tasks. They believed in a method for the church. They understood Christianity to be composed of justification. This was the first step, was that you had to be justified before you can be sanctified. And justification basically means that you have to have made a confession of faith, and the Spirit has to be working in you. And you can see how that very easily moves into Pentecostalism. The idea was that justification, there were symbols or signs that you were justified, that your behavior changed, your life changed. Sanctification followed that, followed by holiness and daily living. And what they were saying was, Oxford was a typical college town. Oxford students were typical college students. Stop being drunk. You know, stop doing all the stuff you do. Get rid of that weird music. Actually, literally, Charles Wesley was a fan of the more metered traditional music. John Wesley was a little more favorite of the modern music of the time. But these were the things. Justification first, which means a public profession of your faith. Sanctification, which means a clear set apart from the life around you, and then a life of holiness. And by holiness, they meant, John thought it meant poverty. Charles thought that was going a little too far. But it did mean to be moderate in your lifestyle, to be dedicated to the work of others. And the Wesleyans adapted the Moravian idea of humility and justification by faith. Very much, they liked Luther's idea that salvation was just by faith alone. Calvin thought it was faith plus works and a few other things, but they said, no, the Bible says it's just by faith, and so that's our central tenet, but that faith is expressed by works and by living a humble life. Remember, they're students at Oxford. Oxford does not promote humility in their students, and they this far back, they didn't either. And so the Wesleyans are really taking a step away from the classical education they're receiving. Next slide. Okay, church has very humble beginnings in the United States. In 1774, there were fewer than 1,000 Methodists in the United States. The first church synod where the pastors of the Presbyterian Church got together was in 1775. There were 18 Methodist ministers in the United States. But Methodism takes root in the United States pretty much for the same reason that it did in Europe. The Anglican Church is for the high and the mighty. The Presbyterians are for the middle class. The Methodists are for everybody else, the poor. Remember, their focus is on humility and service, and it became very clear to Charles and John Wesley that the regular churches had just said poor people aren't worth the time, and so they started focusing on ministry to the poor. Remember, debtors' prisons existed in Europe at the time. If you fell into a certain amount of debt, you went to jail until you could pay the debt off. What's the problem with that? Well, you're in jail. How are you going to pay the debt off? And so what would happen is then the state would confiscate your property to cover the debt, and then you'd stay a little bit longer, and then you'd get out of jail, and you wouldn't have any property, which would mean that you would have debt, and you'd wind back up in prison. As a consequence of that, they had a large orphan population. How many of you remember the line out of A Christmas Carol? When the people come to Scrooge and ask him to donate to the orphans ministry, what is his line? Does anybody remember it? Are there no prisons? Yeah. And I mean, literally, that was the solution. If you were an orphan on the streets, you'd eventually wind up in prison. And the Wesleyans said, you know, there's something we can do about it. The Wesleyans, the Moravians, the Anabaptists, all worked together to address that problem. They created orphanages. It was out of the Methodist and Anabaptist movement that we get the free hospital movement. All of these elements grow out of the Methodist effort to try and make life better for the poor and needy. And one of the areas in which they were attracted were the coal towns in Cornwall. Cornwall was a large coal mining area, tin and bauxite. And when Methodism came to the United States and they got in places like Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, mining is a large part of what those colonies did, and so the Methodists wound up there as well. As you can see, by 1792, there were almost 80,000 Methodists, and by the time you get to 1850, the Methodist Church is the largest denomination in the United States with over 1 million members. Now, what's characteristic of the Methodists? The Methodists were circuit riders. You generally had one pastor who was responsible for 5 or 6 churches, and so he would ride the circuit to do ministry. And so basically, typical Methodist church in the South would have meetings every 2 weeks. The minister would come in, he'd deliver books and materials, would deliver a sermon, would develop the laity. He'd spend a couple days working with some lay folk who could minister the spiritual needs of the community, and then he'd head on and around. And then every 2 weeks, he'd come back through. There are a couple places in Tennessee where the Methodists still do this. which is, you know, you think nowadays it's kind of pointless, but it's been a tradition. A number of congregations eventually adapted that. The other thing that the Methodists did was the tent revival. The Presbyterians had tried that. They didn't think it fit in with being, you know, Presbyterian. And so the Methodists did the tent revival and the tent meetings, and that became, from 1820 to really 1899, the big tent meeting, the big revival meeting, was very characteristic of the Methodist Church. Now, Methodism found its home in the South in the United States, grew enormously, particularly in the in Virginia and what's now known as West Virginia. I'm starting a job in Glenville, South Carolina, or no, Glenville, West Virginia, sorry about that. And going through Glenville and driving from Glenville to Weston, I counted 38 Methodist churches in there. And you know, these are all have their roots in this early colonial Methodist experience. The Methodist Church is associated with mountain culture. Next slide. Doctrinally, they are less doctrinaire than the Baptists and the Presbyterians. They emphasize a common form of worship more than they do a specific doctrinal statement. Even today, the church, the Methodist church building is owned by the Methodist denomination. Pastors are assigned by that. The churches are actually called charges. The Methodist church never had that congregationalist motive, which caused enormous conflict when they moved farther north. Methodists are Arminian in doctrine. They believe in free will rather than predestination. Wesley, John Wesley, believed that you could lose your salvation. Talking about apostasy. The Methodists have kind of gone back and forth on this, and I'm not sure where West Virginia Methodists stand on this question, whether you can lose your salvation or not. Does anybody know? I know in Tennessee the Methodists have been kind of driven to the eternal security position by the large number of Southern Baptists that surround them. And I know when you get to New York, the Methodists and the Presbyterians believe that, that it is possible to lose your salvation, but I don't know what the West Virginia stance on that is. Anybody? I thought I saw raising hand going up.